Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Mona Shaw, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, Mark. How are you? Well, I should say we are cold and snowy, but well.
Ooh, cold and snowy. Well, I'm glad I'm not cold and snowy here in sunny Atlanta. It's mid-50s, which is cold, but at least the sun is out.
Right. Well, I'm very happy today that we have Reed Thomas from NES. Hi, Reed.
Hey, Mona. How are you?
Good. You're here in New York for a reason, which was spoiled yesterday by the snow, right?
Well, it was almost spoiled.
We
were here this time for doing our annual roadshow. We do this once a year. The whole idea is to talk about current issues and trends in the business that are really hot.
And there the EB-5 that, business.
Oh, absolutely, in the EB-5 business. And they're things that cause challenges for people or, in fact, create opportunities. And so the whole idea is we want to promote solutions that either allow people to take advantage of those opportunities, developers or regional centers specifically, or help them stave off the potential issues and challenges.
Right. And your roadshow was, I understand, you were down in Florida. You were in California.
Right. We do three cities every year. We do LA, Miami, and then we do New York. And New York is usually extremely well attended.
Yes.
So that's why we do it last, so we get it right. but we didn't predict the weather this year. So we had 300 people register, but to New York's credit, we had over 120 people in the room.
Well, considering the blizzard
that
we had yesterday.
It was crazy.
The fact that we still don't have power.
It was crazy. Yeah, it's tough when that happens, certainly. But I didn't have the power challenge. I just had to walk across the street from the hotel and get my shoes wet. But many New Yorkers brave the elements to come to our event, and it's very much appreciated. And I hope they learned a lot.
And you had fantastic panels yesterday. You had some great speakers.
We did, but we missed you. You were stuck out on your in Long Island and weren't able to come. But yes, we did have some great panels.
Almost stood in my place well, right? He was good.
Oh, he stood in your place. He did very, very well.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and so who were the speakers who you did have yesterday?
Well, we had folks from all different kinds of the industry, right? We have some of the leading immigration firms. We have some of the leading securities firms. But we also had some of our clients, you know, some of the developers or regional centers who are experiencing some of the trends that I was discussing.
So what was the main topic of yesterday's conference?
Well, we call it an innovation summit. And the idea is NES is trying to be innovative every year, and that's how we continue to differentiate and stay ahead of our competition. So we're introducing innovative solutions. And this year we were really focused on a trend that we're starting to see emerge, which really is this convergence between private equity and EB-5 capital. And, you know, every year at this event, I spend some time reviewing data that we've aggregated out of our customer base. Because, you know, with 550 some projects now, we have a pretty good market share, and that gives us an opportunity to kind of look at different trends. So it's not the whole market, obviously, but I think it's representative of things going on.
Right.
And one of the things we saw going on was this trend where increasingly we're seeing developers not just look for EB-5 capital, but give that very same investor the opportunity to invest alongside in a private equity way.
I have to agree. Right now, we have several projects. And interestingly, they're not large projects. They're smaller projects where a developer has sought capital and someone, not just from China, people from Latin America and other parts of the world have come in with additional capital.
In fact, that's what we're seeing too. This was fascinating because, you know, usually China is what everybody talks about in the EB-5 context because so much volume comes from there.
Right.
But in this specific trend, we see more momentum in other markets, in the emerging sectors. So Latin America is a big deal for sure. Europe, Middle East, South Africa, it's an enormous trend we saw.
Well, the good thing is that it hasn't slowed down since the new administration. If anything, the new administration has given the feeling to investors that at least real estate markets and generally that America is a good place to put your money.
Yeah, we're really optimistic about this year in the EB-5 industry.
Do you think anything has got to do with the fact that there's a lot going on in Europe, like Brexit, from England and such? Because I know we have a case, we have a project with some South African investors who always went to the UK. And for the first time, they're coming to the US.
Wow. Yeah, we definitely believe that sort of that political unrest is driving demand. I mean, the U.S. has always, I think, been perceived as a great place to live and invest.
As long as you can get in.
As long as you can get in legally. and actually, we shared some data at our event on what's driving some of those trends. What kind of real estate do folks like to invest in, et cetera?
Okay. Well, I didn't give you a proper introduction, forgive me, but tell us a little bit about what NES does. I know you guys have been around for an awful long time.
Yeah, we started the company in 2005 with a pretty simple idea. The idea was that there's certain types of financial transactions where banks might be generally afraid of dealing with the money, where there's a lot of compliance and reporting requirements, where there's the potential or even, in fact, a history of fraud and abuse.
Well, the thing is, Reid, I mean, I was doing EB-5 in 2005, 2006, and nobody understood EB-5 in 2005 and 2006, 2007 and 2008. In fact, I would say that up until maybe 2012, did we see any significant changes?
Well, exactly. So we weren't in the EB-5 business until 2010, in fact. You know,
right.
We were doing, like, there's plenty of financial sectors that suffer from these kind of conditions. So we started off doing something called 1031 exchanges. Just Google that. There's been, unfortunately, some fraud and abuse there. We became the largest provider of those services in the country. On an annual basis, we process about $75 billion of 1031 money. But we came across EB-5 on like my third day with a company. And it was, wait a minute, this has the same characteristics exactly. So we built a solution to do escrow administration. And then over the years, we've continued to innovate, adding more and more solutions to get us to the point where we're at.
Right. And I've noticed also that you are in other markets. I mean, you've been on the front of EB-5 magazine, and you know, I see you all over the place.
I'm sorry. My picture on the front of the magazine may not be the greatest, but thank you. Yeah, you know, what we're trying to do is get this message out in the industry about how important it is for security, transparency, and compliance. So we're really talking about this notion of due diligence 2.0, I guess.
Right. Well, this is where a lot of people get confused. So I wanted to really simplify this whole process.
Sure.
Here. Now, obviously, there are the developers with the big projects. I mean, people who want 50 investors plus. But we are in tune with a lot of small developers who maybe have a project which is only requires 7 million. Is NES, is that too small for something that NES would come into?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sometimes people have that perception.
Yeah.
The reality is the average project size that we do has been historically at about $50 million every year. The median project size is actually $20 million. Wow. And so if you look at, you know, we've done 500 and some projects. We've done lots of projects less than $20 million. And so one of the unique things solution-wise is that to build a solution that can scale down like that for the smaller client, as well as scale up for the big New York person raising $2 billion, well, then you have to build something that's pretty unique. And that's helping us in the private equity space.
Right. Well, the other thing is that we get a lot of investors or people who are wanting to go for an EB-5 project, and they're looking at various factors, trying to do their own due diligence here and there. And one of the things that we always tell everybody is to see, well, who is the bank? Is there a third-party administrator? And then we have to explain what a third-party administrator is. And for most smaller projects, there is no third-party administrator. But first of all, I could ask you, please explain to our audience what is a third-party administrator and the fact that USCIS right now are really advocating towards it.
Oh, we could talk about this for a long time.
Mark will stop you if you...
Okay, Mark. So a third-party fund administrator is an independent company that provides a level of tracking, oversight, or controls over the movement and management of the money.
So if a developer has gone out of his way to get a third-party developer in, that obviously shows a lot of integrity towards the developer.
Exactly right. And so when I'm in China, as you said, I'm on the front of the China magazine a few months ago. The reason is because I'm trying to educate the market that that's the point, right? And actually in our roadshow, we were able to demonstrate based on some data that the projects that actually adopt these third party best practices, like we're talking about, actually fund faster.
They not only fund faster, but they have a more solid funding, I always see. So I will totally agree with you on that. But this is the issue. again, we're talking about the smaller developer, not the larger developer. Very few banks deal with escrow now, this EB-5 escrow, number one. And number two, whenever you do go through maybe an escrow bank or a third-party administrator, there's A, issues relating to control, and B, a holdback, as in some part of the EB-5 money is held back, and a developer doesn't want to do that. He wants or he needs all the money up front straight away.
You're touching on a couple of different issues, right? On the one side, you're bringing up a real important point, is that many people in this business underestimate the banking complexity, right? There's 6,000 and some odd banks in the U.S. today, and there might be less than maybe a dozen at most that will take EB-5 deposits on a regular basis.
Yeah, we've had Signature Bank on the show, and they are one of the big ones.
Yeah, we do a lot of business with them as a partner, and we have other bank partners that we work with as well. And the banks like to partner with us because what we do is we help mitigate their risk, right? Because, you know, you think about a $30 or $40 billion bank. EB-5 is a small, niche market by that standard, right? And so for our company, this is a huge focus area for us. The rules are always changing. You know this better than anybody. The rules of the game are always changing. And it's what happened last week in the regulations or legislation is always evolving. So
it's almost as fast as Trump administration here.
Yeah, exactly. The first 2 weeks were a blur. But yeah, exactly right. So by partnering with us, we mitigate their risk to do that and help them get comfortable with this because it's got all the things, foreign money and OFAC and
yeah, but
all that.
If I, on the part of the developer, the small developer who needs the money, he's going to be like, I don't really need to do this. My investors are kind of comfortable. Why do I even need to get a third party administrator in? Or why do I need to use an escrow account when EB-5 doesn't require escrow?
Well, you're right. There's no law that says you have to use escrow. It's really become a best practice, I would say.
Right.
And the demand is usually pushed from the investor side. You know, 100% of the projects that we've seen have this pledge to repay the investor their subscription money if that initial 526 petition is denied.
Right. And if you've already put all of your capital into the project and there isn't any so-called third-party best practices there, and the project doesn't get approved, then what happens to that investor?
Yeah, where does the money come from?
Yeah.
And that's the bank issue, back to complexity, because at the end of the day, the bank is the one with the deep pockets in this transaction, and everybody's going to get sued. And so that's one of the big issues that's difficult for banks to deal with, because as you alluded to, these ideas like holdbacks or these complicated escrow structures to help mitigate that risk even further complicate the process.
Right. Well, the interesting thing about EB-5, unlike investment programs in other parts of the world, is that we don't have that many regulations. Well, at least not yet. Not until we get the new stuff.
True.
And the regulations which are there are not regulations which really impede the private enterprise. So the way it works here in America for our foreign listeners is that you have a business, you're a private owner, and you bring a business together. You will not really see government involvement here, right?
Exactly,
like some countries in the world and some countries where our investors come from, there's a lot of a government involvement or people are scared, they can't do this and they can't do that. That really doesn't happen here. But because of the growth of EB-5, a lot of these practices have evolved.
Yeah, there's a few things going on. You know, one, we talked a little bit about private equity and how it's converging with EB-5. Well, these kinds of best practices are commonplace in the private equity world. But in the EB-5 world, because it's growing so fast, they're not. And so what we're seeing is because of the profile of this, the recent frauds and abuses, what we're seeing is these things being imposed legislatively into the EB-5 side.
You're talking about the integrity measures.
Yeah, exactly right. So at the end of the day, you end up in the same place, but it's being forced into the EB-5, I think appropriately, forced into the EB-5 realm.
Yeah, no, I agree. But with regards to the frauds, I mean, for the amount, you yourself say that you have over 500 projects.
Mm-hmm.
There are 900 plus projects out there at the moment on the market.
Okay.
The fraud elements, I know they're there, but they're really a handful in comparison to how many projects they're there.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you know, this was discussed at our event yesterday, that if you look, compared EB-5 to any other sort of financial sector, the fraud and abuse is really no worse than any other.
But
the profile of this is
yeah,
huge.
Yeah, exactly. And I've said on this program many times, there's a huge difference between a developer who intends fraud and a developer which just has a bad project.
Yeah. And I think one of the things about EB-5 that sometimes people forget is that, and this gets to the important parts about fund administration that we provide, I think, because it's different.
Well, what is fund administration?
Well, it's really this third-party monitoring of funds, okay. Right?
And I'm sorry mm-hmm. to interrupt you, but what does that mean? I mean, for people who are listening who really have never heard of this before.
The EB-5 process is a complex process where money flows through different entities over an extended period of time.
Right.
Best case, maybe 5 to 7 years, right? And as part of the immigration process, it's essential to be able to show a few things, that the money was fully invested, that it remained at risk, that it created jobs. And so that involves a tremendous amount of tracking in ways that go way beyond what traditional private equity funds need to do, because there's that immigration job creation layer added on top to the traditional investment view.
So if we had a listener who actually has some additional funds and they were thinking of investing it into maybe a private project, would they come to NES?
No. NES is, you know, we're not a registered investment advisor. We're a provider of services to issuers is what we do. And the benefits of our services extend well beyond just to the issuers, but also to all stakeholders, the banks as well as the investors.
So really the purpose is that we actually are explaining to our audience that these services are available and they should be used, and they are being used by some of the better projects.
Well, in fact, yeah, exactly right. And so, in fact, I showed a chart where there's a breakdown of how these services are being adopted. Right now, overall, it's at about almost an 80% rate. So 80% of the projects coming to market now are using these types of services. And interestingly enough, 100% of the larger projects do, because that's just the way they operate. So for a smaller project to compete...
Oh, smaller projects are. And I know you have...
Oh, smaller projects are, sure.
And you have some direct pooled non-regional center projects, too.
Absolutely. Single investor projects, even, right? And so if you're a small project and you want to compete against the big projects, you kind of have to offer that same levels of security and transparency to the investor. Right? The investor can log in using our solution and see exactly where their money is at any point in time.
Well, this is a good point also, because we have a number of clients who are direct pooled clients. And with a direct pool client, we often have an investor asking who is going to be the person who oversees them, because sometimes that's the role which goes through a regional center. And for a direct pooled, you don't have that. And that's where those direct pool people who've gone to NES have said, well, we have a third party administrator there.
Exactly right. And so we try to help our clients promote their projects so that investors are easily aware that we're involved through our medallion program. We've extended that medallion program, as you know, to also include partners, because one of the most critical success factors is who the team is you're putting together. So that's why we partnered with you to become an NES medallion partner. And we display that on our website here and internationally as well. So if you're thinking about, you know, selecting a team, pay attention to that.
Thank you.
Sure.
One of the points which did come out from yesterday's show, yesterday's roadshow, was the fact that, yes, this is happening more and more often now that people are putting in capital. People are investing more in over and above the $500,000. But that also shows another thing, Reid, that the quality of the projects have changed.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's back to, you know, the quality of the projects have changed, the quality of the people have changed, the
right.
quality of developers have changed. My gosh, this industry has changed since 2010, certainly when we got in.
That's right.
It's much more institutional in a way.
I know, when we look back at some of the documents of some of the first projects, and we sort of cringe those even got through, but they did.
They did? Okay, that's good.
Have you ever been brought in? We have a number of attorneys who listen also to this show. Have you ever been involved in dealing with RFE issues or problems with relating to maybe construction of a project?
Well, we help our clients when these types of things come up. You know, we're the dominant provider of these kinds of services in the market. And so you'll recall there was some confusion in RFEs a few years ago relating to holdbacks.
And escrows, right.
And escrows, yes, in escrows. Yes. And of course, you know, at that point in time when that whole thing came up, we had already
maybe
11.
Maybe you'd like to explain it a little.
Oh, so the point is, it used to be that money was held in escrow until the petition was approved or denied. But the time processing has gotten so long now, it's not practical to do that anymore.
Right.
So money's getting released early. We call it early release. And so, you know, as you point out, what happens if the money's not available to repay the investor because it's in the project? Well, this is where these ideas of, well, maybe we hold back a portion of the money until the approval. And so that became kind of a common way to address this concern. And then after we had already processed, I think at that time, about 1,200 successful 526 approvals using that language. Then RFEs started to show up after they moved the processing center from LA to Washington. And so we did help get that cleared up.
Right, but the RFEs at that time were focusing on the fact that not all the money was at risk, right?
Well, that was what was alleged.
Yes.
But, you know, at the end of the day, we proved, of course, it's all at risk. Of course, it's all invested, right? Because obviously when the 526 was approved, that remaining holdback money was immediately released,
right?
So it was all in the project. And so it was just interesting. And those kinds of things can happen because USCIS is, you know, the industry's exploded. It's growing rapidly. And so they're seeing more and more applications and petitions coming in. So I know they're working really hard over there.
And have you improved at NES? Have you improved your process over the years to meet with all the growing demands?
Well, we think so. We continue to innovate. You know, we started out just on the escrow business, helping the banks mitigate their risk and helping investors see where their money was. And then we realized, wait a minute, there's a bigger issue here, which is investors are really in this for a successful immigration result. And that's really dependent on how the money and information is tracked over the whole life cycle. And so we introduced that solution a number of years ago, really oriented at providing that benefit.
Right. And the last stakeholders meeting, but the one before that, either one before that or before that one, I do recall that the director did state that they were advocating towards projects using third-party administrators just for the simple sake of it being more transparent.
I agree. And I think it makes perfect sense, right? If you're a bad actor, you're probably not going to hire NES Financial.
Exactly.
To track the money,
exactly.
Right? So we can start from that or another third-party administrator. You can start from that assumption. And therefore, I think that's a logical approach for USCIS to consider.
And how does NES help attorneys?
Well, so we have a variety of different products, obviously, one of which we call Immigration Workflow. And that really is a place where all of the immigration-related documentation can be tracked. So as I described for fund administration, where we're tracking the movement of the money over the life cycle, in parallel with that, there's a whole immigration process, 526, 829, RFEs, all of those things. And so we have a tool that can consolidate all of that information in one place, meaning when it comes time to file, say, an 829 petition, it's much quicker to get access to the information you as an attorney would need to help that investor.
So this process or this particular section would be just given to attorneys, or is it given to the project?
No, it goes into the project.
Okay.
Right? Because the project, at the end of the day, the regional center is obligated to provide certain reports to remain in compliance, right?
Right.
So at the end of the day, they're providing a service to the investor and should be paying attention to these things. So we're not trying to replace a lawyer's case management system. That's not what we're trying to do. But what we're really trying to do is consolidate the information to help the lawyer be able to do the appropriate petition filing, and it increases the likelihood of an immigrant's success. And that's what it's about.
So, Reed, I can definitely see the advantage of third-party administrators of escrow accounts as being advantageous for investors, especially as you mentioned, they have the ability to log in and see what's going on. But what about developers? You mentioned that bad developer isn't going to come to you, the good ones, because of the tracking and oversight and control that they know that you're going to do. Can you explain a little bit about what this tracking and oversight and control is and how NES Financial does that?
Sure, be happy to. So the developers are real estate developers. This is a different thing, right? What we're doing here is tracking the flow of the money into the project for ultimately a job creation and immigration result. And so if a developer doesn't hire an independent third party to do that, then presumably they have to do it themselves. And so that's a burden outside, I would say, the natural comfort zone of what a developer wants to do, right? Which is build property, right? Is develop property.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of developers complain that they think EB-5 is hard, whereas if they did use or utilize all these tools, they wouldn't even think it's hard because somebody else is doing the job for them.
Well, exactly right. So they can just outsource, if you will,
yeah,
that whole problem to NES. So NES becomes the back office, takes care of all of that work. Because we've built technology to automate all of this, it's extremely efficient and I think very cost effective for them to do that.
Yeah, your prices are not high. I have to say that.
Oh, maybe I should raise them. Just kidding.
So it sounds like maybe you're tracking I-9s, but you're certainly tracking the development spend. So as developers spend money on certain activities that the economist said this money and these activities would create jobs, your system essentially says, you know, these jobs, the money has been spent, so these jobs have been created, but this other money has not been spent on these other activities, so these jobs have not been created. Is that a somewhat, you know, good interpolation of what you do?
Yeah, I think there's a few elements. So you're talking to proving that jobs were created, and that's a critical part of it. And you're exactly right. Tracking those expenditures gets that done. But you also have to show that per investor, that investor's $500,000, not a penny less, was invested in the project. So there's some fundamental tracking and audit trails that need to show exactly where the money moved and provide the supporting evidence to that. And then you have to show it remained at risk for the whole time.
Right. Well, you see, Mark, often what happens is that once the money goes into the developer's hands, it's not so easy to track. And when we get to the A29 stage, we've had situations where there have been multiple transfers to lots of different accounts for one reason or the other. And many times it's very genuine, but you could have some nefarious activities slipped in at the same time. So that's why the, you know, USCIS are taking an awful long time now to get the 829s approved, because I do believe that they are spending longer looking at the tracking.
Right. And nefarious or not, even if it was all spent legitimately, if they're really looking at and scrutinizing the 829s, I can see why Rita's saying that the RFEs come up, because people are saying, you know, did this money go towards these activities to create these jobs? And that's one of the criteria they're looking for at the 829. The money was at risk, and the money was used to and continues to be at risk, and the money was used for these, you know, economic job creation activities. So I can certainly appreciate a system that would track the money was spent here to do this, and therefore these jobs were created based off the economic analysis that, well, you know, you've already signed off to.
Right. Well, it sounds easy. A lot of times when we discuss projects,
the concept is easy. It sounds like an IT nightmare.
It really is. And often we talk to developers, and we always advocate something like NES from the very outset. And the developer says, no, I don't need that. I'm fine. Oof. I have my little secretary with a little notepad, and she's jotting everything down. And I cannot tell you how many times we have looked for the brick wall for banging our heads when we get to the 829 stages. And the more one understands this whole process, the more we feel like, why are there not multiple NESs out there?
Well, I'm sure you appreciate better than anybody, right? The feelings of these folks who are trying to achieve green cards and citizenship, ultimately. It's a very personal experience for them. Being an immigrant myself, I know how personal that is.
An immigrant from where?
Oh, Canada. So it's a lot easier, but yeah, so it's a very personal thing for a family to decide to do that. And I think a developer owes it to that person to do everything they possibly can to help them achieve that outcome.
So, Reid, I'm going back to one issue which we touched on before, which was third-party escrow accounts and the fact that it really isn't in the legislation at all. So nobody really needs an escrow account. But what are the advantages of having an escrow?
Well, it protects the investor, and it also protects the issuer, I believe, by putting additional controls in place. However, it's getting complicated because the processing times don't line up with the reality of when capital is needed by developers. So this year, we're going to innovate and introduce a new solution for escrow that is, I would say, next generation escrow, by combining our escrow capabilities with our drawdown account control capabilities. Because when you look at how deals ultimately get structured, it's really on the drawdown and the controls in place during the loan process that's the critical piece.
So it sounds like the law doesn't require these third-party oversights of escrow, but you know, it certainly benefits the investor and even provides some protection for the issuers. So
yeah, the law doesn't require that today, but the draft versions of the law are getting tougher and tougher in this regard. And the latest version clearly specifies that this is a requirement.
Right. And as an attorney, we encourage it at every stage.
Absolutely.
Right. Reid, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice and explaining to us NES Financial's innovative approach to third-party administration of escrow accounts.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.